Is there a way to reduce the appalling toll of suicide?
Using a poly pill to decrease heart disease.
Can we use some of the kidneys that are now discarded for transplant?
And the association of educational attainment and causes of death.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on September 6th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to toss the ball right to you this week and ask you to talk about a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, taking a look at the relationship between educational attainment and death.
This is important because there are substantial and actually increasing educational differences in the U.S. among whites and blacks, and also life expectancy. What the authors did in this study was they looked at life expectancy at age 25 and the causes of death. And to do that, they looked at over 2 million deaths in 2010 and about 2.5 million deaths in 2017. And what they discovered was that between 2010 and 2017, life expectancy at age 25 significantly declined among white and black U.S. residents by about 0.2 or 0.3 years. And for that short time period, that's really pretty significant. When they looked at it by educational attainment, if you had a college education or higher, your life expectancy actually increased. But if you only had a high school education or less than 4 years of college, your life expectancy decreased, primarily attributed to drug use.
So I guess one factor I'm interested in is the relationship between drug use and college education.
Well, Elizabeth, this is just an association right now, but it's clear that over the last 7 years, drug use has increased in white men, white women, black men, and black women. That's primarily limited to individuals that did not have a college degree. In black men, the second most common cause of death in that age group was actually firearms.
Clearly important to identify these factors. Let's turn from here because it's kind of a natural progression to Annals of Internal Medicine, another major cause of death and one that's increasing, and that's suicide. It turns out that between 1999 and 2016, suicide rates have increased 25%. There's an even greater increase among veterans. And so in this particular review, they took a look at, what can we do to intervene in this? And this is from the Veterans Administration. This is a rather exhaustive paper, and for those who are involved in either primary care mental health, which they identify as the specialties that are most likely to be able to intervene and to correctly identify a risk of suicide, very lengthy algorithms for, first of all, identifying those folks. And that screening and evaluation, they point out that sometimes asking people about suicidality or suicidal ideation may put that idea into their heads, and that may get them to start thinking about that when they may not have been previously. Basically, they admit that this points to the need for a better screening tool or tools than we have right now. The compensatory strategy they suggest is to use more than one if you suspect somebody is at risk for suicide in order to confirm the results that you might have. Having identified somebody who's at risk for suicide, clearly then they need to be referred for management and treatment. They talk about some pharmacology, and I'm a little bit unconvinced by some of this, at least at the moment. When somebody has depression, they do say that a single ketamine infusion may be helpful. And I think we've talked before about the use of ketamine, and maybe that is going to be helpful, but I know that these studies are underway. So right now, I'd like to see some more data relative to that, particularly regarding the durability of that strategy. And then for those who either have unipolar depression or bipolar disorder, lithium might also be helpful. They also talk about the use of cognitive behavioral therapy to reduce suicidal ideation and behaviors, and then some other flavors of CBT that could be helpful also. And they say that a crisis response plan for people who are at risk is a tool that could also be employed and that may be helpful here. Clearly, to hearken to what you've just talked about with firearms, they say there's a lot of evidence to support implementation of what they call lethal means safety, especially including firearm restrictions. And in this population, the VA population, who have extensive ability to use firearms, they know how to use them correctly. And so the likelihood that they're going to be successful in suicide is higher. And then reduced access to poisons and medications that are associated with overdoses, and the access to jumping from lethal heights.
About 20 veterans die by suicide each day. And compared to civilians, the veterans have a 20% higher suicide rate. But as you mentioned, this is not just a VA issue. This is a United States issue, because suicides have increased across both veterans and civilian populations. And one of the things that I found disappointing is that most of the evidence is actually pretty weak, even for those things that we're suggesting, which indicates we need to do additional studies to evaluate what the most effective way is for assessing and managing this particular issue.
I at least am glad to see that there's a focus on this, and I feel that we're paying a lot more attention to it nationally as well.
And I agree.
Let us turn to your second one, and that's the potential for use of a thing called a poly pill for the prevention of cardiovascular disease in The Lancet.
In full disclosure, I must say that in 2001, when the poly pills were proposed, I wasn't a big proponent. Now, a poly pill is a pill that combines the use of blood pressure lowering medications, of medication to lower cholesterol, statin, and aspirin. Because my thought was, well, why would you take a poly pill when you could take each of these pills individually and more effectively manage the doses to achieve a desired outcome? But in many low and middle income countries, these medications may not be effective and follow-up may not be effective. So the question is, can you use a fixed dose poly pill just across the population to reduce cardiovascular disease? That's what this study did. It was a very pragmatic study that looked at over 6,800 individuals in rural parts of Iran and randomized them according to village. And they followed individuals for 5 years, and half the group got the poly pill. By the way, if they had a side effect from one of the blood pressure lowering medications, the ACE inhibitor, if they got a cough, they had a second poly pill that didn't have that. The other group just received training about healthy lifestyle. And what they discovered is those individuals that got the poly pill, it reduced their risk of cardiovascular disease by 33%. And importantly, it didn't really depend on whether the patients had a previous history of heart disease or not.
Well, I actually like this idea of the poly pill, and I think I advocated for it when we talked about it a few years ago, because to me, it simplifies the whole regimen. Not to mention the fact that we know that lots of people don't like to stay on their blood pressure meds. And so if you put them together with all the rest of this stuff, maybe it's easier just to toss that back and forget about it.
So you're right. It's the ease of taking it, and it's low cost because these are all generics. And because they're low to moderate doses, you don't have to worry about side effects of having too much blood pressure lowering medication or excessive risk of bleeding. In fact, when they looked at adverse effects, there was no difference between those that took the poly pill and those that did not.
And I'm going to just back you into a corner here and ask for your opinion. And we've quipped in the past about, gosh, should we put statins in the water? So what do you think about the prophylactic ability of something like this, even on a broader basis, even in high-income countries?
The people that receive the most benefit from it are those that have the highest risk. And obviously, whenever we use any treatment or medication, you're weighing the risk versus the benefit. So if we had healthy lifestyles and healthy diets and low cholesterol, a statin really offer very little in terms of risk benefit. But how do we gauge that? Well, we talk about how many patients you need to treat to get an effect. And in this particular trial, the poly pill, you needed to treat 34 patients to present one of the cardiovascular events I mentioned. Should a statin be in the water? Probably not. Should it be available for individuals that are at risk for cardiovascular disease? Absolutely.
So finally, let's turn to the last one for this week. That's in JAMA Internal Medicine, and this is taking a look at kidneys for transplantation. There's a huge deficit of those organs. There are actually quite a large number of people who end up dying on the transplant list, nearly 5,000 people in the United States and more than 3,000 people in Europe. This is really a modeling study using available data. They took a look at transplant, shall I call it, behavior in the United States relative to kidneys that are acceptable, and they compared that with France, where the guidelines as well as the incentives and everything else are a good deal less restrictive than they are here in the United States. In kidney transplant centers from 2004 to 2014, very large number of kidneys that were recovered from deceased donors in the United States during that time, almost 160,000. About 18% of them were discarded. In France, the comparator, there were almost 30,000 kidneys that were recovered in that time period, and only 9.1% of them were actually discarded. The French program, of course, transplants kidneys from older donors. And in the US, I would add, they also disincentivize programs to use kidneys that might be somewhat questionable because there are penalties that could actually be applied to programs that have outcomes that are substandard. They then took a look at this French allocation model and compared it to the US one and said, well, what would happen if we relaxed all this stuff and transplanted some of these other kidneys? That would have generated 130,000 plus allograft life years in the United States if these guidelines were relaxed and older kidneys were transplanted. In France, they also have this issue where they transplant older kidneys into older recipients. And so they identify that as also a factor that helps to improve the outcome relative to the benefits of the procedure.
Two-thirds of the kidneys that were discarded in the U.S. would have been used in France. One has to look at the alternative. We're talking about individuals waiting for a kidney. These are individuals that are on dialysis already. And what the data would suggest is that compared with dialysis, even the lowest quality kidneys lengthen the lifespan on average for the transplant recipients. Taking kidneys in which there's a slight comorbidity, such as hypertension or even, in fact, diabetes, may be more beneficial than having the patient on dialysis. So I hope that this study really has us look as a nation about how we can more effectively use the kidneys that are available.
One of the things that I would like to have seen in this study that's not here would be a cost analysis. And how much does it cost to actually transplant a kidney versus what's it cost to keep somebody on dialysis? We've talked before about how dialysis is improving. And I'm just wondering about that. I know that dialysis, of course, for people is really troubling, especially as their kidneys get worse and they have to have it more often. It really defines their life. And so being able to get off of that is a great outcome. I'm still wondering about the cost-benefit ratio.
Well, this particular study doesn't address it, but multiple studies in the past have and have shown that transplant and all the associated cost is still less expensive than dialysis and the problems associated with it. So that's why having more kidneys accessible is so attractive, because it lowers the cost of healthcare, it improves the quality of healthcare of the recipients, and it lengthens their lifespan as well.
Well, we'll look forward to more about this. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.